No, but before you get to get started here, the problem is the timing of this whole thing, as you all know, in order to get the platelet through the process.
Part of the problem. The other problem is what the building looks like when it leaves the center. If people are going to put oil and gas amendments on it or different committees, I got a problem with that. You've got amendments, so it's getting hurt. That's what I want.
The same meeting I went to.
I mean, this is the oil and gas committee, so if you've got oil and gas amendments, let's bring them here.
I understand.
Same thing you do. You're the chairman of the oil and gas committee. Call a meeting to order. We're going to hear the SJR 28. All right. Please join us here, Kathy. Identify yourself. Tell us about the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kathy Hathaway, and I work for Senator Kutula. SJR 28 is a fairly straightforward resolution encouraging both the governor and the president to expeditiously appoint members to the presidential task force that is resulted from the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, and which is going to be conducting an audit of TAPS, a two-year audit of TAPS. The reason for the resolution would be that the results of this audit would, as Senator Kutula feels, that they would be useful in encouraging further oil development. Basically, I guess that's all I have to say. Ricky Ott is also here, and I know that she'd be able to answer any questions anybody might have.
Any questions for Ms. Hathaway? Thank you, Kathy. Do you have anything you want to bring up here?
We just have a description of the task force.
Did you wish to testify, Ricky?
Yes.
My name is Ricky Ott. I'm representing the Oil Reform Alliance. I'm a commercial fisherman out of Cordova. Senate, the need for a Trans-Alaska Pipeline presidential audit was evident after the oil spill when other problems with the system surfaced, like specifically corrosion in the pipeline. And so it was felt that not only was there still danger of water, marine oil spill, but also there was land spills along the pipeline, and also the potential for spills related to exploration activity. So it was decided that the whole system should be audited. And this would best be done by a, as it says in the Act, seven-member team, half appointed by the president and half appointed by the governor. Unfortunately, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 took so long to get through. It wasn't authorized until August of 1990, that by that time it was too late to get any money appropriated to this task force. So right now we have a task force by law, but no money for it. And what this resolution does is it kind of reminds the governor that it would be that not only should this job be done, but we also would like it done right. And that's why we really support the one resolution in there for the one whereas phrase on page 2, number 9, for the Citizen Oversight Council. Page number 14, line 14, for the Citizen Oversight Council to have input into the governor's choices. And we would encourage this to be done. This whole inspection process is really critical because as more North Slope fields come online, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System is like an integral part of this, and it needs to be working as best as possible. And so that's the need for this resolution. Thanks.
Are there any questions on this?
I just have a question about form. Do we usually do resolutions where some of the whereas's ask the governor to do something, and for some of the resolves ask the governor, and other resolves ask Washington? That's not typical. We usually have separate resolutions, I think.
It possibly could be because the presidential task force is a split. Like I mentioned, 3 members are to be appointed by the president and 3 to be appointed by the governor. So maybe it would be appropriate in that case.
Sounds like it's the conservation measure here, save paper. Any other questions? Anyone else wish to testify on this, Jerry 20th? Mr. Treadwell, yeah, please join us.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mead Treadwell. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. I wanted to just bring the committee up to speed on some of the other measures that are being taken to accomplish what this audit was set out to do in federal law, and also to let you know we do support creating this audit, but we're just not sure it's going to happen, and wanted you to be aware that we're covering it other ways. The first thing is that the state pipeline coordinator's office has come together, and it has Fish and Game, DNR, DEC, and on the federal side, BLM, U.S. Department of Transportation, the Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife Service, and shortly, we believe, EPA. And we have brought together the combined federal and state oversight of the pipeline now to try to do a better job in doing what the audit has set out to do. Second, the audit has asked for an independent look at corrosion. We have put together a corrosion team with the representatives of these agencies, federal and state, and they will be examining all components of the system over the next 20 months and looking into the corrosion problem in great depth at a technical level to begin with. The third thing is that the General Accounting Office is already is in the process of completing an audit on the pipeline now, and it's looked at compliance with applicable laws. From the top of the pipeline, the ballast water treatment plant, we are reviewing the strength of laws, regulations, and permits to protect the environment. And because of the recent Persian Gulf War and occurrence since the OPA 90 was passed, we were forced to do an immediate review of security of the pipeline as it was a likely terrorist target. Finally, the Pipeline Safety Office has just completed a thorough review of Alyeska's oil spill contingency plan. So a lot of the concerns that Congress may have had when they passed this authorization have already been taken place or addressed by the agencies. Yet the governor and the federal government take this very seriously. The governor has requested advice already from the DEC and DNR commissioners on appointments from their departments. The governor's already notified George Miller, who sponsored this measure, that he has names ready for the president whenever the president requests them. I guess the main reason why I sought to testify is if the committee wants to make any modification of this resolution, it would be to look at the other parts of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, which made a number of substantial promises to Alaska that we're also afraid won't be kept. One of them is funding for research, Prince William Sound Oil Spill Recovery Institute. There's a submittal of an oil pollution research and technology plan to Congress that is already several months late, and the funding of a national regional research program. And we have a Spill Technology Review Council on the state end that is kind of standing by and waiting to work with these federal programs, but we would like to see the federal programs funded. Secondly, in referring to the Prince William Sound Oil Spill Institute, if that were funded, I think the long-term research that's necessary into the effects of the oil spill would have a vehicle to work with there, and so it would be helpful if in addressing the President and Congress and asking for funding of certain programs under OPA 90, you also addressed research. We are working with the Coast Guard to make sure that the promise of the law of associations under RCACs comes into being. We are working with the Coast Guard to get full implementation of regulations for strengthening contingency plans. And we may well be sending DEC staffers to Washington on a loan of employees to help write out those federal regulations. We have already addressed and have called for stronger regulations in implementing the double hull provision of OPA 90. And we are, the Spill Tech Review Council has asked the Corps of Engineers to cooperate to see how dredges can be converted to skimmers, which is something that was called for in that law also. So I think specifically the one promise in OPA 90 that has not been matched with federal funding is the research promise. And we'd recommend the committee or the legislature in passing this resolution also call for the federal funding for the research that was promised in the law.
Any questions? Pete, I'd ask you to get back with our staff and do as formal an outline as we can put together in the form of a proposed amendments to this resolution. I think you make a good point that if OPA 90's promised an audit and a committee to do that, and other things that have been promised through OPA 90 that may be as important or perhaps even more important as far as funding and so forth, the research programs, this may be the appropriate place to do that. I'll personally check with the sponsor of the legislation to see what his feelings about that effort might be, and bring this resolution back up at a later date.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on SJR 28? Any other comments from the committee on that? Any other interest? All right, we'll take up Senate Bill 263 at this time, and the schedule for today is we're not going to move the legislation today, but we will hear from people that have proposals for amendments to the bill. If committee members have those, any proposed amendments, we'll give them an opportunity to discuss those. I know that Mr. Ringstaff from BP would like to make some testimony as far as amendments that they're interested in. And if we have time at the end of the hearing, there's at least one person on the teleconference network that wanted to make general comments. But we'll get to the regular business that was announced first. So I know that Senator Pierce had mentioned an interest in some potential amendments. I don't know if you want to discuss those at this time.
Do we have anything in writing?
Yeah. Okay, we have. Does everybody in the committee have these from the department? You want to join us again, meet and walk through these with us?
Chairman, at our last hearing, your last hearing on Senate Bill 263, we discussed two potential amendments that were supported by the Department of Environmental Conservation. The first amendment on page one of what Deborah has provided in your packet basically removes the 10,000 barrel cap on the study of oil terminal facilities and basically asks for us to study non-crude facilities of 5,000 barrels or greater, and that changes that in the base law. I have tried to get for you this morning a good cost estimate of what that additional studies would cost. At this point, I would say that the upper limit of that additional study would be $300,000. We are in the process of preparing a formal fiscal note. I hope we could do it for less, and we're going to look at that further. And that's $300,000 in addition to the 60. Okay, so that would actually raise our $60,000 fiscal note to $300,000. The second amendment that we have suggested to you would basically not only look at the costs of the of implementing this law on the vessels and the barge owners and the operators and the persons they serve, but also would look at the benefits of this law through avoiding cleanup costs through implementation. Basically, that was based on the point that we made the other day that while we understand that this will raise the cost of fuel at various points throughout Alaska, and we are sympathetic with that. We also know that any day a bell can ring and a village or a community is in asking us for emergency response funds to cover a facility that right now doesn't have sufficient prevention and response capability, and then it really costs money. And I just felt it was important that we take a look at the risks of not having this law in effect for non-crewed carriers, as well as the effect that the law will have on the price of fuel. And so we've prepared language accordingly.
Any questions or comments in the committee on these? Mr. Hoffman?
I guess I just have one comment. If I think that there are a lot of problems with the small refiners that need the studies, but if it's the committee's desire to have this addressed, I would say that we should take the studies out, both of the studies out, and put them in a separate piece of legislation and let them run their course. I'm concerned primarily about the effective date, and I would oppose the amendment, first of all, but if it's the committee's desire to have this done, then that this be stripped out and a committee substitute be adopted, and we proceed strictly with the extension or the lapse of the effective date for non-crewed only.
Anybody else? Do you have any other comments on these amendments? Could you go back to the first one there?
Sure.
For a moment and help me understand this. I apologize for not studying this beforehand. Right now, you're expected to show back up next year with a report that now you want to change the parameters of that report. Is that?
Yeah. Basically, Mr. Chairman, under the law passed last year, we have two studies that are in the process right now being completed to be returned to you. One is due at the end of this fiscal year and the 1st of July, and the other is due late next year. One is basically an inventory of tank facilities between 5,000 and 10,000 barrels, and the other is a transportation study. What the inventory would do would take off the upper limit of 10,000 barrels, and basically do an entire non-crude storage inventory for the entire state.
Why was the 10,000? Limit put on there to begin with?
The 10,000 limit was put on primarily because this is the number or an average number of crude facilities in smaller areas, in rural areas of the state, and I wanted to look at some of the economic factors that this legislation would have on those small users, primarily in rural areas of the state of Alaska.
You're on amendment number two now, aren't you?
I'm saying why you asked why the 10,000 barrel was there. That's not the amendment. The amendment is to lift that 10,000.
Right.
Barrel.
That, the existing law says that there's a 10,000 barrel, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So you're saying that was because that's the a typical maximum size for a rural storage tank.
Yes.
And frankly, Mr. Chairman, we I think we're well on the way to completing that study now. We heard the testimony that you heard the other day from several of the co-op electric companies and so forth that have tanks bigger than 10,000 and just hoped that they would be included in the inventory there. I'm personally very concerned about the fiscal vote and can tell you that it's right now on the back of the envelope, and we plan to try to reduce those costs because that's the business we're in at this point. Anyways.
What business is that?
Trying to reduce cost of government, sir. So along those lines, hearing the public's concern that we look at all of these tanks, which we proposed language taking off that cap.
Well, maybe I'm not sure as to the reasoning. Again, I stated that it was primarily for rural concerns, but I'm not too sure of that. And maybe if there's someone that has a better knowledge of why the 10,000 barrel limit was placed in the legislation.
Madam Chairman.
When we got into the discussion last year about what we had out there, the universe, so to speak, to use one of your favorite terms, of storage facilities, DEC at first wasn't sure. Mr. Dietrich went back and brought to us a list, and we showed a number of facilities in the state, but a small number of facilities that had storage capacity of more than 10,000 barrels, and 10,000 seemed a likely cutoff point where we needed to survey to see what we had out there below 10,000. And the 10,000 hit some of the larger villages. I believe it hits Fort Yukon, it hit Galena, it hit Barrow, some of the more what we consider to be kind of regional, sub-regional hubs within the state that did hit more than 10,000. And you had to choose a number somewhere to decide what to survey under, and we chose the 10. Because we could identify everything we had that was over 10, and quite frankly, we couldn't for sure identify everything that we had that was over 5,000. We just weren't sure what we had out there, and that was a real big concern to everyone. So that's where the 10 came from.
So, I guess I'm pretty slow here, David. So you're saying that they already had a pretty good inventory of those things, those
over
10,000. So,
I think that's correct. We've got a fairly good inventory of them. The difference in numbers, Mr. Chairman, is there's approximately 40 tanks that would comply between the 5 and 10,000 barrel limit, and 183 tanks that are crude, non-crude, most of which are non-crude, over 10,000 barrels. So it would be expanding the scope of our inventory largely. Most of the people who own these larger tanks are already quite in touch with the department, are working on contingency plans right now. We have most of the key information about that. That's why I told you I suspected the 300,000 number in the first place, given that the initial additional study of the fiscal note was $60,000. You know, we would be doing our best to try to include those based on information that we have in-house without spending additional funds.
Well, it's pretty compelling to hear the, you know, an agency with an attitude that you're trying not to spend very much money come and say, actually, you have to actually admit that you do need more money to actually do it, you know, a job that needs to be done here. So it's a benefit, I guess, of having that attitude to start with. Your credibility factor is pretty high. Senator Pierce?
Would you just run through those numbers again? How many tanks do we think, or facilities do we think we have that are between the 5 and the 10,000?
Right now, I believe that inventory was looking at 40 or 41 tanks. I've seen both numbers.
And you feel comfortable that you have identified all of them, you know, where they are and who they are?
I feel comfortable that we have, and we've hired Arthur D. Little to work on this study, and a reputable national firm with a very reputable local office. So far, things seem to be going fairly well.
What would the department's position be if we put an upper limit of 150,000 barrels on the study?
I have no idea what it would change as far as the numbers right now, so I just can't say. I'd have no problem with that if you wanted to do that. Basically, what we heard in the testimony the other day, Mr. Chairman, was a number of operators who say that they're just over 10,000 barrels one way or another and feel like they've been cut out of the study. And these people were saying to you that because we're cut out of the study, they weren't sure that they were being addressed in terms of the cost of this law on them. And they were many of the same constituents that I think Senator Hoffman was concerned with addressing. I'd have no problem with 150,000 barrels. I wouldn't know, you know, where would be the best place to draw the line. It might be 100,000, it might be 25,000 barrels.
Maybe you could give us some sort of a graph or chart that shows, you know, you said, what, 183 were over 10,000, so.
That's correct.
How many are over 150,000, you don't know right now, but if you have the info, you could probably display that pretty easily.
Sure.
Yeah, that'd be good information, I think. Anything else on these amendments proposed by the administration?
Did you discuss the second amendment?
He discussed it, but were there any questions about the second one? No, briefly go back over the one on page two.
Mr. Chairman, basically where the current legislation asks us to study the costs of implementing this bill onto vessel and barge owners and operators and the persons they serve. What we suggested is that you also ask us to make you aware of the costs that not having this legislation, the cost of responding to spills because we had not increased our response capacity, is to the same people and the state. And you know, it costs you one way or another. It costs you if you have a spill, or it costs you to prevent a spill. And we happen to believe that the cost of prevention are less than the cost of cleaning up a spill. And the numbers that we heard the other day from one group of, put it at $7 million, I think we can turn around and look at the cost that the response fund itself has had, not to speak of the cost that others have had in the past to clean up spills, and $7 million is a low number. We have a tank spill right now in Galena that will probably cost the Air Force hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to repair, where I'm very glad that we have this bill, because they're, you know, from here on out, they've got to have a better response capability than they've had in the past. And so the overall cost to users of not having these things in place in the long run, Mr. Chairman, may be higher than the direct cost that we're putting on users to have this equipment. I also want to stress, and I stress this with the sponsor of the bill, that we would like to do everything we can to encourage creation of co-ops, creation of cost-sharing techniques in this. We're glad that the bill calls for a broader plan to look at where to put depots, where to supplement this with government and so forth. And our objective is to try to make the cost of compliance with this law as low as possible, you know, and yet be in compliance with the higher planning standard that the law calls for. We're sympathetic to the concerns of the operators.
Mead, does the CERT plan, which I know is in draft form or some form, I haven't seen the latest version, does it identify spots for some of the depots, or have we not, has CERT not gotten to that point yet? It says we will identify them.
Yeah, CERT really hasn't gotten to that point. We've addressed this issue in the proposal for spending on that budget component. We have approximately $3 million in authorized this year, and frankly, that may not be spent, and then may be returned to the response fund for next year, where we requested another $3 million. At this point, the feeling between our department and DES, which would actually administer the depots, is that it may be better to have the depots close to an airplane sitting next to a HERC so they could be anywhere, that spread all over the state. And just taking a look, for example, Alyeska has spent something on the order of $60 to $100 million to increase its response capability in Prince William Sound. CISPRI is spending in the tens of millions of dollars as well. You have a response fund which has to do half a dozen different things and has an income of approximately $30 million a year. And if you're looking at that funding source, our estimate of what would be available to depots may only be in the $3 to $5 million a year capability. So we have not drawn up a specific plan for any other place. I've testified on the response action contractors legislation that's wending its way through this legislature, that we've heard the National Oil Industry Group MSRC has said that they would be willing to come to Alaska if they get that bill passed. We'd like to we'd like to see a larger response capability in Southeast Alaska and Western Alaska than there is. We think Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet are fairly well covered in comparison to what we've had in the past. And so what the SERC co-chairman, General Cox and Commissioner Sander have said is that they want to wait and see, finish the survey of response capability around the state, and then make a decision of placing depot facilities outside one central area, which would probably be Anchorage at this point.
Senator Pierce doesn't have proposed language today, but did want to discuss another area of concern.
When we passed 567 last year, I just want to start by saying that I'm quite comfortable with putting into effect on June 1st for crude the 72 hours planning standard for having equipment on site to handle the containment and cleanup of a spill. Where I have a question and where I think we may be heading for difficulty in anybody trying to write their plan on June 1st is when we get into what happens after the first 72 hours. And if you don't mind me reading to you for just a minute. In the bill that we passed last year, when you get beyond the first 72 hours and the containment and cleanup equipment that you have to have on site for that first 72 hours, get beyond that, and we said that in addition to the minimum equipment, personnel, and other resources required by A and B, the plan holder shall maintain, either within or outside of the plan holder's region of operation, additional equipment, personnel, and other resources sufficient to contain or control and clean up a realistic maximum discharge within the shortest possible time. The plan holder must demonstrate that the equipment, personnel, and other resources maintained outside the region are accessible to the plan holder, will be deployed and operating at the site within 72 hours. Once again, it's a planning standard. Once again, there was a lot of discussion over the fact that if you chose a maximum realistic spill of X number of hundreds of thousands of barrels, probably, and let's take Alyeska and one of the tanker companies, let's take ARCO as an example, they can probably show that they can identify equipment and they'll have it on its way. There was a lot of discussion, and we all admitted that if you have all this stuff coming into Cordova, Anchorage, Valdez, and wherever else they could fly into, there's a distinct possibility that they couldn't have it all on the water and doing whatever it needed to do within 72 hours, but at least they'd have it there. And we wanted it into the area, even if it wasn't operating yet. Where I think you run into a problem, and it's what we've been discussing back and forth, is there is not yet a definition that has been agreed on, as I understand it, in the regs of what a realistic maximum discharge is. Without knowing what that is, it's impossible to give to DEC a list of the equipment outside and say that you'll have it on site if you don't know how much equipment you got to have, if you don't know what the planning standard really is. And that's where I think that we've caused kind of a box that you can't get out of. If you don't know how much you got to have, you can't say you've got it, and yet we tell them we got to say that they have it, and we also want them to show us that they've got contractual arrangements with Southampton in fact, we told CISPRI that we wanted them to have a contractual arrangement with Alyeska where they could pull some of that equipment over into Cook Inlet if necessary. We said we wanted to see equipment move back and forth, but there's no way to tell how much. I plan to go to Anchorage to the advisory group meetings next week to talk about the definition with the group, and they continue to work on that, but right now I don't think you've got a number that you can give anybody for them to do their plan and have it back to DEC and show that they've got this equipment, because they don't know how much equipment they need.
Who knows this for tank vessel?
I'm talking, this covers everybody.
Well, with the regulations,
this covers
treat everybody differently. For crew, I mean, they treat tank vessels one way, or oil terminal facilities another,
extraction
pipelines.
Not for this part. They do for the original 72 hours. But this is what you do after that for 72 hours, that you have equipment coming in for the realistic maximum spill. And I'm speaking primarily to crude, but it also affects non-crude, because they don't know what their maximum real, it's The problem is that we don't have a definition of realistic maximum allowed discharge, and unfortunately...
I think they're doing that in regulation right now.
Well, they're trying, but they don't have it yet.
Well, now, what do you have? I mean, I'm told that you do have, most, for the most part, for at least tank vessels, after 72 hours, it's 60% of the cargo capacity.
For principle of sound.
Right.
80% for cooking.
Right.
Well, that doesn't, wait.
Maybe I'm thinking, are we talking about two different things here?
There was never a distinction that there was just going to be a percentage. This is a risk analysis that we were told by Mr. Dietrich was going to be put together, computerized risk analysis for each individual case, where you put into the analysis the facility, what sort of prevention measures had been taken, you assign a certain analysis to that, and you come out with a realistic discharge for each individual case. And it's, you can't say it's just 60% or 80% because you don't have that statistical analysis.
Yeah, that's in the draft regulations where they have it right.
That would be in the absence of prevention or medicine.
Why don't you join us here and talk about these issues that you can identify yourself.
My name is Mike Mansker, and I chair the House Bill 5. Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Mansker. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and I chair the House Bill 567 Technical Implementation Work Group, which is attended by six representatives each from agencies, from public interests, and from industry. And we've been struggling with this question of RMOD and how it's presented in the bill and how we're going to implement contingency planning based on the definition of RMOD for some weeks.
So, my staff gave me a set of cliff notes here on what the statutes now determine for different circumstances, and it appears that for instance, at a terminal facility, which is one of the areas covered here, that the statute said the capacity of the largest oil storage tank at the facility within 72 hours. And if the department determines high-risk area, it may increase volume requirement. And the department's, or the regulations are the same, obviously, under those circumstances.
Yes.
Wait, what do you think?
It's quite a definition. So, but if you go with the, well, they list different areas, right? The pipelines, if it's, or terminal facilities, or tank vessels, or non-crude. And if you go to crude oil tank vessels, the statute says, 50,000 barrels within 72 hours. After 72 hours, realistic maximum oil discharge. And then the regulations say that that means that if the cargo capacity is over 500,000, then 300,000 within 72 hours. And after 72 hours, 60% of the cargo capacity. So it appears that you, by regulation, you're already finding what realistic maximum oil discharge is. And if we are talking about two different things, help me.
We're talking about the same thing, but just flat saying that 60% is going to be it doesn't take into account any of the things that we told you in the definition to take into account, nor does it in any way, shape, or form meet what the legislative intent was last year, nor what we were told by the department that you were going to do.
The draft response regulations were promulgated without benefit of having drafted the prevention regulations, and so you're exactly right. It doesn't do that. It wasn't intended to do that. It was intended to set the planning standard to which prevention credits would apply, so that risk assessment and application for a risk-reduced planning standard would be based on that initial planning standard. The problem that we're having in implementing the bill right now is that RMOD, the realistic maximum oil discharge, is seemingly used in conflicting ways in the bill. In the definition, it's called the most damaging spill that the department estimates could occur in the lifetime of an operation, and other modifying words. Some of those words indicate that we ought to take into consideration some of the realities of the individual operations, weather, and some other things that people have hinted means a risk assessment. Other people have concluded that where there's a historical case for setting the most damaging spill that could occur, we should use that historical case. And what we've, the position that we've taken now in the work group, or where we think we can resolve this, is to use RMOD as it's defined in the bill. We feel like we have no choice but to use it as defined in context for the beginning of a planning cycle that would take risk analysis and prevention measures into account in coming up with the planning standard. The bill, unfortunately, also sets out planning standards and then starts to mix terminology by using RMOD as a planning standard or referring to it as part of a planning standard. So clearly in the minds of the members of the work group, there was intended to be a planning standard, which is distinct from the place where you start the planning cycle, and that is with the worst case spill. The most damaging spill that the department estimates could occur.
So it sounds like you
suggested. You need to read the minutes.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you are suggesting that there might be a definitional problem there.
Yes.
No, I mean, in the existing law, isn't that what you
this
suggested?
Is the existing no, I don't think there's a problem with the definition. I think what they're doing is saying that they're taking this definition and saying that they don't have to do the statistical analysis that they told us that they were going to do. Instead, they're just saying, oh, that means 60%, or oh, that means 80%.
But that's before they get to the prevention regs that might further define that, is the way I understood him to say, is what
yeah,
I understood
him to
say.
He's
not finished.
You have to take the prevention stuff in to come up with this number. It takes those prevention, the analysis takes those prevention measures in to come up with the RMOD for each individual facility. And
that's one hell of a sentence that you wrote, by the way.
Talk to David.
We gotta get some abbreviations in there, so we don't have to, you know, shorten up a lot. But,
anyway, that's the circle that we're in, and I would like to continue talking to Mr. Treadle about it, because I do think that we've got a problem. I don't know that you need to change the definition. I don't know what we need to do, but I think that we've got a situation where we've got a cycle that you can't meet the planning standard at the moment by the time we put this thing into effect on June 1st, because you don't know what your standard is.
It also
makes absolutely no sense to tell anybody, okay, you're going to meet 80%, have them go ahead and rush out and buy, because they have to show that they've got this stuff coming if it isn't already on site. You've got to go out and buy this stuff, and then when we get around to doing your analysis, we may tell you you didn't need it. Well, now what kind of sense does that make? It makes no sense at all for whether you're talking about a village, a city, a company, no matter who you're talking about. So, and unfortunately, last summer this whole thing kind of fell through the crack when they changed the companies that were doing the analysis for them. So that's kind of got where we are.
Sir,
I was just going to offer where I think we're headed in terms of resolving the conflicting interpretations of RMOD and the bill, and that's that. In the work group, we have reached at least close to consensus that there is a tiered planning cycle that makes sense in terms of both the realities of operating a oil vessel or a facility and in implementing the bill, and that's that you start by looking at the most damaging spill that could be expected to happen, and then come down to a planning standard based on what somebody could reasonably be expected to be able to do in terms of attacking that spill, and that would take into account system changes that have been made to reduce the risk of or to reduce the size of a potential spill, and that we would have an additional planning standard that would be based on individuals applying for an exception to the planning standard that the department sets out based on the circumstances at the individual facility and based on prevention measures that they put in place that exceed the system changes. In other words, they would bring to us a risk analysis making the case for adjusting their planning standard down based on the realities at their facility. And that seems to make sense to the members of the working group.
That's not what we were told, nor is it what we said.
Well, the working group, quite honestly, has been really struggling with the bill and how to implement that.
I'm aware of that. That's why you're talking about it.
I didn't get a chance. I know you had a note from David Rogers there that
But it spoke to financial responsibility, which is a whole other.
I said, I'll just admit that I hadn't read that.
Yeah.
All right.
So, Pierce, I'd be happy to meet with you and brief you on what's been going on with the working group and to discuss potential amendment language for RMOD or whatever you want to do.
Okay, well, that's what I would like to have to do. And I'm also not trying to hold up Senator Hoffman's bill, but I think this is definitely the place, if we need to make some changes, this is the place to do it.
This
and I know that
RACAC
has been
bill.
Having some, they had David Rogers, who was counsel to the committee last year, is now on contract to RACAC and just completed for them an analysis of some of the regs. And I don't know if it was the whole thing or not. And it's one of the things where he and I discussed back and forth because he called and asked me as he was putting that together. And that's how I became aware of the questions that are out there. So I know they're there.
Okay. We bought ourselves into it.
There have been, Mr. Chairman. Some members of the work group have counseled against opening House Bill 567, fearing a dogpile syndrome where everybody wants to come to the table at the last minute and throw in their two cents on what the bill should have said in hindsight. And I believe it's possible for us to implement the bill as it's written now. So I'd just like to offer that I'd like to talk to Senator Pierce about that too.
Yep, a lot of people have that concern. Thank you very much. John, did you want to testify? Does anybody else going to want to talk today?
John Ringstead, I represent BP Exploration. We are interested in trying to expand this bill to include crude oil also. There are a couple areas of concern in the implementation of this and are trying to pursue that and get clarified as to exactly where we are and what the answer to the problem is. But it would be in our interest to try and get this bill broadened to include not just the refined products, but also the crude products. It's not our intention to slow this bill down. We feel that there are a lot of the people in the state, the refined end, that have a problem and need to have that extension and be addressed. So we don't want to try and get in the way of doing that. But we, with the subject that is there, we would be interested in doing that. And we want to try and do whatever it is that Chairman, people feel we need to try and do to work with you for the next 3 weeks to accomplish that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ringstead. I have good information if anybody that's interested. I met with Mr. Ringstead and Mr. Cannell yesterday, and they're going to bring some additional folks from their company to Juneau tomorrow, I guess, or the next day. So we may have not quite spontaneous, but we'll have a working session, and I'll try to announce that as quickly as possible. The bill won't formally be before the committee, but there'll be a work session to listen to what your interests are there.
We'll be happy to do popcorn. We got good at it last year.
All right. So we're going to, the people that are on the teleconference that didn't get a chance to testify, my staff's going to call you. There's only three of you, Mr. Mullen, Mr. Smith, and Mr. Snelling. And make sure that we understand what your interests are, and we'll try to make it possible for you to testify at another date.
And Mr. Schwartz.
Anybody else in the room here need to say anything today? All right, we're adjourned.